In the final decade of the 21st century, men and women in rocket ships landed on the moon. By 2200 AD, they had reached the other planets of our solar system. Almost at once, there followed the discovery of hyperdrive, through which the speed of light was first attained and later greatly surpassed. And so at last, mankind began the conquest and colonization of deep space.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of Forbidden Planet.
Commander, if you set down on this planet, I warn you that I cannot be answerable for the safety of your ship or your crew.
A Podbean backer review chosen by Clark Fisher.
The total potential here must be nothing less than astronomical.
Nothing less. The number 10 raised almost literally to the power of infinity.
Hosted by Stuart.
A simple scholar with no ambition beyond a modest measure of seclusion.
Jacob.
You ought to see my new mind. Up there in lights.
And Arnie.
Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
Your best procedure will be to turn back at once without landing.
Listener discretion is advised.
Honey, let's do this thing right. Here.
Today we're discussing Forbidden Planet, starring Walter Pidgeon, Anne Francis, Leslie Nielsen, and introducing Robbie the Robot, directed by Fred M. Wilcox. This is the Now Playing co-host who, if you don't speak English, I'm at your disposal with one other language, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is the host who's a low-grade moron by Krell standards, Jacob.
Well, you know who's not a low-grade moron are any of our patrons. Thank you, patrons, for sticking with us. This is kind of an unusual pick, but this is picked by one of you, Clark Fisher. Thank you, Clark, for pledging the large amount to have us go back in time to an early sci-fi film.
Yeah, we haven't covered a lot of films from the 1950s. And to be quite honest, we haven't been that kind to the ones that we have. Why did Clark want us to talk about what is reputed to be the best sci-fi film of 1950s?
What he said was, it's a film he regularly comes back to. He thinks Gene Roddenberry probably watched it several times, coming up with the blueprint for Star Trek. And I couldn't help but think Star Trek. You can have a drinking game, listeners. Every time I mention Star Trek or Gene Roddenberry, take a shot. And he just thinks it was very influential with Robbie the Robot. He thinks it may have inspired C-3PO with the millions of forms of communication. And beyond that, he thinks the theme of evil in all of us is intriguing. And he thinks the production values, particularly the Krell complex, hold up well. And he knows, Stuart, you're not a fan of 50s sci-fi, but he wonders if you'll find something to like here. So he decided to have us go ahead and do this. Is this our earliest film ever, 1956?
Oh, not at all. Remember 1951, The Thing from Another World, where I said I don't like 50s sci-fi. Also, that first Superman movie. Yeah, we covered one from 1951. He fights the Mole Men.
I forgot all about Mole Men, and I wasn't sure if Thing from Another World was before or after this. But I am a newbie to Forbidden Planet. I've never seen it before. I put it in. I was surprised it was in color, to be honest.
Same with me. Yeah, I'm also a newbie. I thought this robot was from that Lost in Space TV show. Maybe that's why I thought it was in black and white. I don't know, but yeah, never seen this one.
3 for 3 then. I've seen what I thought was a lot of sci-fi from the era, and I always kind of get stuck on a few things. One, they all kind of hit the same theme. Usually there's two ideas. We're exploiting our fears of the atomic bomb. The potential for science to unleash mass destruction was well on our minds at the end of World War II. So we had all of these early disaster films, really, where radiation makes these giant monsters, Godzilla, Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, the giant ants from them. You know, they're all going to come and do mass destruction. Yeah, usually with models or what have you. And then the other theme One that's a little more appealing is that fear of Russia, the Cold War, and the anti-religious threat of communism. And that was something we talked about with Mole Men and Thing from Another World. And when I talked about Invaders from Mars, you know, I went back and saw the original. Body Snatchers, certainly. I mean, it was the era where Senator Joseph McCarthy was going after everyone that he thought wasn't patriotic enough. And so you'd have these movies where, yeah, aliens were snatching your body and making you do their bidding.
Yeah, that's what I think of when I think of 50s sci-fi. I think I mentioned this with Thing from Another World. The majority of 50s and 60s sci-fi I saw was watching MST3K lampoon things like the Gia monster and all of that. So, I mean, I'm familiar with the tropes, I'm familiar with the stereotypes, but I just have never seen the classics. This I've not seen. The Day the Earth Stood Still. The original War of the Worlds. I just haven't gone back that far to 50s stuff. It doesn't hold that much of an appeal for me beyond, as I've often said, horror homework. This is my sci-fi homework. I've wanted to see some of these films for a long time because I want to see the roots of sci-fi, but I've just never gone back.
For me, you know, certain decades are good at certain genres. And the problem with this decade and this genre is that there just wasn't a lot of respect for it. So the good filmmakers weren't making those films. With the exclusion of Howard Hawks, Thing from Another World, he's a very good director. I'll even throw Robert Wise in there. I know he made Sound of Music and Star Trek the Motion Picture. I don't like those films. But because they had to make them on a lower budget, which means compromising the special effects, it also meant that they had to appeal to children. And so all of these interesting themes and these paranoias, they end up coming out in very simplistic, cheesy ways. I mean, the appeal is stilted by the presentation. And so lack of money, a lack of subtext, or rather a lack of ability to really dig into that subtext, it's a challenge for me to get excited about paper plates on strings.
Yeah, for me, it's that sophistication because, like you said, it's there more to appeal to children. It's just not as interesting. When I go back and I watch something from the 50s or 60s, it's a drama or it's probably something foreign, more likely. It's just because, yeah, oh, the Soviets were so scared of them and this is going to appeal to children. So there's not a lot of subtlety, which it's just not as much fun for me.
That said, I really do like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, 1956. And I'm really intrigued because this is sort of the next era of sci-fi in the 50s. The early ones were made by independent studios or made at studios with very little money and expectation. And then come the mid-decade, we're now seeing the major studios throw a whole lot of money at them. And Forbidden Planet is one of two of those works. The other one was This Island Earth. I don't know if you know that one, but Universal Studios, they went color, had a really cool bulbous brain monster in that one. Otherwise, a pretty bad film. It's actually the film that MST3K spoofed when they made their big screen movie. If you see Mystery Science Theater 3000, the movie, they sit there and watch This Island Earth. But it was Universal splashy sci-fi movie. And then MGM, the studio known mostly in this decade for musicals. This would be what I would say Hollywood was doing well in the 1950s, Singing in the Rain, movie musicals. They said, let's put $2 million, that's a whole ton of money, I know it sounds like nothing now, CinemaScope, Eastman Color, we're doing things in a way that sci-fi hadn't been done on the big screen. It's going to be the Star Wars of the 1950s, except it's not going to really make any money. It just doesn't have enough appeal at this time to really do anything more than break even.
But it certainly had legs. I mean, it is one that, even if I hadn't seen, I knew stuff about. I, like Jacob, didn't realize Robbie the Robot wasn't from Lost in Space, but Forbidden Planet was one that you've heard bandied about, and I've watched so much making of both Star Trek and Star Wars in my life that it's one that is constantly referenced.
Oh yeah, even my girls, when I put this on to watch it and they saw Robbie, they're like, we've seen that robot, we've seen posters of this. So, you know, whatever comes after millennials, that generation, Robbie has made an impact on.
Yeah, I think the two things that I knew, Id Monster and Robbie the Robot. I knew it was influential, but again, that's not always a selling point because sometimes you don't want to read the Greek myth that inspired the movie that you know, like, I just want to get to the thing I like. And I do feel like sci-fi, for me, really kicks off with 2001, a decade later. Like, it is really hard to go back to this time. But obviously, yes, there's going to be a lot of influential work, design work here. And I do think that as I turn on the film, I am seeing a better looking film than Day the Earth Stood Still, War of the Worlds, or any of the others. It was nominated for Best Special Effects. It was the only Oscar it was up for, and it did lose to Ten Commandments because, you know, Charlton Heston parted the Red Sea.
He deserved that one, yeah. But let me tell you how little I knew about this movie. We talked on previous podcasts when we mentioned we were doing this, that this was a film with Leslie Nielsen and we'd be forced to take him seriously. I knew so little about Forbidden Planet that when I actually watched it, I forgot he was in it until the end credits rolled. I didn't even recognize him because he was so young.
Yeah, same thing happened to me. About 20 minutes in, I went to IMDb to look up a character's name. I'm like, that's Leslie Nielsen?
Yeah, I think there's only one true star here. There are people that audiences in the 1950s would know. I mean, I definitely feel like Edward Mobius is Walter Pigeon. He was an MGM contract player that had been in a lot of hit films. But I do think the star of this movie is Robbie the Robot.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Anne Francis. I mean, she'd done quite a bit and continued to do stuff. When I looked her up, I mean, Funny Girl and Pancho Villa and Ten Commandments on TV.
None of that had happened yet.
No, but I'm saying she went on to do stuff and she'd done stuff before. As compared to Robbie the Robot, he's being introduced here.
I'm going to stand by this. Robbie the Robot will work again. He is the biggest star they got. The other thing I knew about this was that supposedly it was a retelling of The Tempest, which I had skipped out on in high school. I never read the play.
Yeah, that one is not in my Shakespeare repertoire. Romeo and Juliet, King Lear. I don't know The Tempest.
Yeah, I went even deeper. I took Shakespeare in college, but that wasn't one we got to. We did Richard III, Much Ado About Nothing, some of the others, some of the sonnets, but I've never read The Tempest or seen it performed.
Yeah, I saw one movie adaptation. It was a loose adaptation at that. And I would just say, having read the play for prep of this, not one of my favorites of his, and really only superficial comparisons. Honestly, I see as much of, you know, the Book of Genesis and Freud in this as I do Shakespeare, but there is, superficially, there's an old guy in both of them who is a magic user who's been outcast from civilization. In the play, it's Prospero. He was actually dethroned by his brother, and he and his daughter were cast out to sea. They take refuge at an island. He learns magic from a witch. She dies, and she bequeaths him a monster baby that becomes his servant. So I guess that's kind of like Robbie the Robot here. And then he creates the Tempest, the sea storm that actually brings the people that threw him out of Italy to his shores. And they fight for a while. There's a lot of speeches. And then eventually Miranda marries the current king and harmony is found. So you can see trace elements here, but I don't feel like it was, in the end, an important connection to make.
And you don't do a great job of selling Tempest to me. I'm like, yeah, I don't really feel like I need to seek that out either.
Yeah, like I said, I didn't really care for it. But Arnie, why don't you give him the real plot and we can get into Forbidden Planet.
In the 23rd century, mankind has realized the dream of faster-than-light travel and spread our manifest destiny into the cosmos, colonizing habitable worlds. We follow a starship led by Commander Adams, played by Leslie Nielsen. He and his crew were ordered to go to the planet Altair 4 and check on colonists who've not been heard from in 20 years. They arrive to find only one of the original colonists is left alive, Dr. Edward Morbius, played by Walter Pigeon. His expedition was killed, ripped limb from limb by a giant creature, and their ship was destroyed. The only survivors were Morbius and his wife. The monster went away and the couple had a daughter, Alta, played in her young adulthood by Anne Francis. But soon after Alta's birth, the mother died, so Morbius raised Alta on the planet, aided by his robot, Robbie, who can synthesize anything Morbius needs. Adams needs to await further orders, but Morbius pleads for him to leave, lest his crew also be attacked by the monster. As for Alta, she never thought about leaving the planet. She enjoys her time on it, communing with nature, such as the tiger that roams the area. But it's been a long time since Adams' crew have seen a woman. And Adams' XO, Lieutenant Jerry Farman, played by Jack Kelly, makes a pass at the woman, much to Adams' displeasure. See, Adams and Alta are attracted to each other and begin a serious flirtation. But Adams is still looking more into Morbius, aided by Farman, as well as the ship's medical officer, Lieutenant Ostro. And each night, Adams' ship is attacked by an invisible creature immune to all their laser guns. Eventually, Adams and Ostro discover Morbius' secrets. Altair 4 used to be inhabited by an alien race called the Krell. Not the Kree, not the Skrull, the Krell. Their technology was so advanced that they had machines that could create anything they wanted with just a thought. Morbius was only able to figure out their technology by using one of their educator machines, and though it almost killed the scientist, he awoke with his brain capacity doubled, and he's used that intelligence to continue to study the Kree. Doc Ostro tries the educator machine and is killed by it. In his dying words, though, Doc says, "Monsters from the id," revealing to Adams the truth. The Kree were killed by their subconscious, their machines bringing to life their worst impulses. And the creature attacking Adams' ship is a manifestation of Morbius' own id, attacking anyone who tries to take his daughter away from him. Realizing this truth, Morbius confronts the monster and is killed by it. As he dies, Morbius tells Adams how to initiate the planet's self-destruct. Adams does, and he takes his ship with Alta aboard to a safe distance where they watch the planet and all the Kree technology explode into space as credits roll.
You know, it's always one of the fun things when you do go back to the old sci-fi is to see what they're going to predict. And you gotta laugh here when the narrator predicts that we're going to get to the moon by the last week of the 21st century.
That, yeah, I got a good chuckle out of that one.
Or 13 years from the release of this film.
The space race was going on, right? They just didn't think we were going to pull it off.
Well, officially, no. I associate the space race specifically with Kennedy, and they were still a few years from all of that. But there was a lot of optimism. There were people that were signing up.
As far off as they are with when we actually reach the moon, they seem very optimistic. Just a, you know, 100 years later, we're going to have faster than light travel and be going to distant planets. I'm like, we're not going to make that by our 2200.
Yeah, that's, I'm like, it's wishful thinking to think we're going to get to Pluto in 180 years. That's ambitious.
Let alone by 2160, you know, 100 years after we reach the moon. But they set this up, and I've complained recently with all the M. Night stuff about the data dumps at the beginning. Here, I kind of feel this is needed to just get a few things out of the way. What we have is a military movie here. I actually found myself thinking somewhat of Apocalypse Now, where you've got Colonel Kurtz, who's gone off and an expedition to go and check on him and kill him. Here, this could be sailors going to an island. Instead, it's spacemen going to a planet.
Yeah, it totally feels that way. I just started calling them Space Force, but yeah, the chef, like, he seems like that stereotypical movie military chef, you know, the dirty apron and the sideways hat, likes to have a little whiskey.
Yeah, you gotta have him because he's the relatable one. He's the one person on this ship that people in the audience are going to be like, yeah, I know that guy. Otherwise, yeah, unless you've been in the service, probably none of this will feel very familiar to you.
And the thing that really struck me as out of date is not a single woman on the spaceship. I mean, I am thinking Star Trek already because you've got all these military people out in space and they're on a mission to a planet. But it didn't occur to me, even when I'm seeing them on the bridge and they're all men, I never thought there wouldn't be a single woman anywhere on the ship, but no.
And not only that, but, you know, racially homogenous, all white guys. I think it said that they're all superhuman 24-year-old. That's pushing it. Some of those guys look a little older.
Leslie Nielsen's supposed to be 24?
Yeah, that's what's said. I don't know. They've been in space a year, so I don't know if it's aged them or made it look that way. But what we see and what I see as a major difference between sci-fi of the 1950s and sci-fi of the 1960s is in the 60s, we were embracing our diversity. And, you know, it was sometimes it was a clash, but I do feel like the films of that time, the TV, certainly Star Trek, reflected that diversity. And here we're strong because we're homogenous. And that was the 50s. It was idealistic. It was a shining belief in our technology. And yeah, the father knows best.
And this is the kind of thing you'd see in the World War II movies as well. I mean, just a bunch of white guys in outfits saving America.
It is a little Kirk, Spock, and Bones, right?
A little?
There's three guys that matter. The main commander is tough and yet very vain. And even though he'll bark a lot, he will be the one to get all the chicks. And then we got the Astrogator. I guess when you're a navigator in space, you get a cool new title like Astrogator.
Sounds dirty.
And then, yeah, you have the science officer / medic, Doc, who's going to just go around in case someone gets a boo-boo, I guess.
Yeah, when he said Doc and his XO were going with him off the ship, I'm like, yeah, that is Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And I figured they'd all live because there was no red shirt going with them. This really feels so much like Star Trek to me, especially...
They beam them up right at the beginning.
Yeah. I don't even understand what they're doing there.
I don't understand that. I just wrote beam me up, but they're not being beamed anywhere.
What's happening is that they've been traveling at the speed of light, and now it's time for DC, deceleration. So it's for Jerry the Astrogator to slow things down. And there was actually a little bit of cutscene that explains he almost put him inside the star. The reason why it's so hot in there is he cut it a little close, and he should have stopped the ship a little further away from Altair.
That's what I kind of guessed when they say it's hot and then they're looking at the big sun, but then it never went anywhere, so I didn't know where that was going. But I don't know if you guys ever watched the unaired pilot for Star Trek or the episode The Menagerie that cut the unaired pilot into a backstory, but it had Captain Christopher Pike, and he and his first officer and his medical officer went to a planet. And it had seemingly a single survivor. It turned out they were harboring a hyper-intelligent psychic alien race, and there was a romance with the woman. It's like he really did see this as a wonderful storytelling engine where, well, this crew could just go to the next planet and romance the next woman and do it again and again. And even more so than what we saw with William Shatner, that original pilot screams this.
Yeah, I think what Star Trek took from the 50s was optimism. And maybe that's part of what I reject about that decade, is that it's so idealistic about science conquering everything and it'll all go well. But they were able in the 60s, I think, to make the crew a little bit more complex. Whereas here, you kind of lose track of all the other guys, and it just becomes really about what they are going to discover once they get to the surface of Altair 4, which we find out that Bellerophon, I think that's a Mission Impossible 2 reference. It's a scientific mission that landed there 20 years before, has not made any contact with Earth since then. Earth is a year away, so I don't know what they were doing in all that time, but finally they're like, okay, Leslie Nielsen, go find out what happened.
One problem I had with this film, tell me if you guys did, the Doc, the XO, the Captain, they're all three white guys with the same hairstyle. And while there's a slightly different shade of hair color, I got confused. At times, I didn't know who was on screen.
Yeah, no, this is Dunkirk all over again. I can't tell all these white people apart. I had a hard time too. I'm like, I think that's Farman. I was able to keep track of Nielsen's character, Adams, but the other two, I'm like, I don't know. Is that Doc or is that the other one?
I got better with Adams as the movie went on, but in the early scenes, because we only really saw them together, and I could tell when they were next to each other who was who, but when they'd split up, I got really confused.
I could recognize Leslie Nielsen, so that was who I hung on to, was I just assumed that he was our central character here. And as they're approaching, he makes the comment, "The Lord sure makes some wonderful worlds," which I think introduces an idea that's probably pretty important to the theme here. Science is not replacing religion. I mean, there is still a belief, even though we've gone out into the outer reaches of the universe, that there's a higher being. And I will say, it is a pretty beautiful world. My problems with the paper plate on a string are not here. Yes, this is all matte painting work, but I, as someone that has enjoyed movie musicals of this time, and they have a similar kind of hokey studio set backdrop, I think you can appreciate it, artificial though it may be.
Yeah, I don't think these are hokey. I think they are beautiful matte paintings. You know, this is the best they could do at the time, I'm sure, unless they try to make some weird alien location on a set. But no, I think this looks beautiful. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Esquivel, the Mexican composer, orchestra leader. He would do like jazz, bachelor pad music, and yeah, he would have album covers that look like this. I got a couple, and they are beautiful.
And I've seen this landing scene. The time when I had a problem with the paper plate on a string was how slowly that ship comes in for a landing and how it fades to black above it to hide the string. But I actually liked the hand-drawn cell animation when it decides to land and the cool, colorful effects they do. The thing it has going for it is it's stylish. Is it realistic? Absolutely not. I did spend part of this scene trying to figure out exactly where the set ended and the matte painting began and how far the guys could walk back before they hit the wall, but the green sky and the big planet in the atmosphere and the mountains, what it lacks in realism, it makes up for in artistry.
Yeah, and this is MGM. Again, they are known for movie musicals. Wizard of Oz was one of theirs. They pulled a lot of those technicians. So if you're a fan of the 1939 movie, you're going to see, I think, a similar kind of stylization to the way they present this space world.
But I'm going to tell you, I did not figure out this movie very well at all. I had a number of theories, you know, based off of how I've seen every original Star Trek episode at least 5 times. So with that knowledge, I was trying to figure out exactly what was going on. And when they get there, they see a dust storm in the distance, and it turns out this robot is driving some kind of golf cart.
Yeah, I put space golf cart.
It's an atomic car. Everything's atomic, you know, after the nuke. It's like nuclear energy is totally fascinating to Eisenhower America.
I thought for sure this robot was the mastermind behind everything, or he was going to be the bad guy, but I did not trust this robot one bit. I thought for sure you couldn't have this big robot, which I love his head and I love his Knight Rider like light up talk box, but I thought for sure he was going to try to kill someone.
I'm right there with you, Arnie. I thought Robbie was going to be the bad guy. And again, my girls recognize this robot and they're like, oh yeah, he's like holding this girl on the poster like he's kidnapping her. So even my girls thought, okay, this has got to be the bad guy. It's not going to play out that way. But when like they introduced that he can't kill humans, I'm like, that's going to come back and he's actually going to be able to.
I was thinking the rules of robotics and then those breaking.
I love his design too. Trying to think about the classic robots like Metropolis, that was the design for C-3PO. There's something about this Robbie design that actually seems more practical. It would just have sensors spinning around in its head to collect data. It doesn't need eyes and nose and a mouth. So yeah, I think this is a great design.
It looks a lot like a vacuum tube. People probably don't even know what that is, but like you needed such a thing to plug in into your vacuum cleaner back in the day. And the reason for that might be one of the main people that contributed to this design is Robert Kinoshita. He made washing machines. That's where he came from. He came from a very practical application. When you look into the glass at what's going on in the head, some of that is moving washing machine parts. You could throw your shirt in there. He could do a load or two.
I felt bad for whoever the performer is inside that outfit, though, because you say it's practical, Jacob. The thing that's not practical is those legs, those rubbery legs where he can barely walk. I felt so, and he can't put his arms down. I'm like, that dude needs treads.
Which kind of creates the Frankenstein quality and the fact that we're going to find out that our main guy made him. You know, I'm not thinking the Tempest. I'm thinking Dr. Frankenstein, and this will be a creation that goes out of control. We are to look at Robbie with awe, but I also think was suspect. I mean, keep in mind, the robot in Metropolis was also duplicitous. I do think it's just very easy to conceive of all robots, all artificial life, as being very threatening in 1956. So he's really kind of the bridge between Metropolis and HAL in 2001. I think he's probably the most famous robot to occupy the screens in between those times. You guys mentioned Lost in Space. Robert Kinoshita designed that robot as well.
Well, that could be why we're getting so confused. I did look up the Lost in Space robot after, and yeah, they look like cousins, but not the same robot.
They actually, Robbie appeared in a few of those episodes. They had a crossover where they were teaming up. And one of the interesting things when they made this movie was they saw this as a real robot. As you mentioned, Arnie, Robbie the robot was how he was billed in the credits. They wanted you to think that he was autonomous. They didn't want you to know there was a guy and a stuntman, you know, hobbling around. They wanted you to think machine parts were making him go around. So if he was a little bit cumbersome and immobile, that had a lot to do with pistons and gears. It wouldn't be for another decade before really the kids watching this figured out that, hey, this was just a man in a suit like Godzilla.
And you laugh about that and you say kids. I think adults might have believed it, because I don't know if you guys know this story, but when Knight Rider came on in the 80s,
everyone wanted to buy that car.
Adults went to Pontiac dealerships and asked to have the kit car that could drive itself and talk. Adults. So I think that there is a level of sophistication that we have today. We're all jaded and we know how the sausage is made, but at a certain point, people didn't. And you see it on screen and you must believe it, right?
When you read The Tempest, I think of Caliban. The relationship he had with the old man was that he was an unwilling slave. And even though he couldn't turn on his master due to magic, he would end up trying to convince one of the shipwrecked people to kill him because he was so resentful for being in servitude. So that is what I'm expecting to play out as he's coming up to greet these guys and take them back to that swanky mid-century modern garden pad that is the occupancy of Edward Morbius.
Dr. Morbius, the moment we saw him and I see he has a goatee, I now know Robbie isn't the mastermind, but this guy is.
Oh, come on. Even before you see him, his name is Morbius. Morbid. I'm like, they just gave away who the villain is.
Right.
I was thinking Mobius, like Mobius strips.
It's with an R, but yes, I do think the confusion is easy to make.
I just thought they were going scientific, but no, Morbius, morbid, I can see that now.
And Morbius, he was the linguist on the ship. His mission on this scientific endeavor of the Bellerophon was to find alien languages and decode him. He is able to make Robbie because he has decoded the alien lives that have lived on this planet. And so Robbie hasn't always been here. He is the child of Morbius, but he is also the child of alien technology. And when we see them interacting, you know, he's serving lunch and what have you, he has a lot of feminine qualities. I never got that from the posters. You look at Robbie, you don't think of a woman, but he really does start to look like a housewife as he makes the coffee. And I mean, keep in mind, the cook kind of wanted to do him. He's like, is it a male or is it a female? I mean, he had lust in his eyes when they were doing that.
They've been on a ship with a bunch of dudes for a year.
Yeah, it ceases to matter at that point. They do call him the housewife's dream, right? Every housewife would like one that can do the laundry and do the cooking.
Yeah, and that's when I suspect that something happened to Morbius' wife. Because there's this whole very unsatisfying backstory that he gives. You know, he didn't want these people to come down and land. He was like, no, I'm fine. Keep going. I'm going to just stay here for another 20 years. And then they're like, no, give us the coordinates. They come down. He lets them in for lunch and then you'll be leaving. And he's like, yeah, all the other crew were killed by some dark, terrible, incomprehensible force, torn limb from limb. But that was a long time ago. Don't worry about it. I'm fine. And my wife died too. And I'm immediately thinking, again, Frankenstein. Oh, I wonder if her soul or her brain or something is inside Robbie.
My mind never went there, but I never entirely was satisfied with his backstory either. The fact that he left and wasn't married, got married on the ship. I have the paperwork if you need to see it.
Was there a priest on the ship too? Like, you gotta have witnesses, you gotta have signatures.
No. It's maritime law, Jacob. You can be married by the ship's captain.
Okay.
I'm serious. I mean, that's like the big thing, right? It was always a big thing on the Love Boat, is the captain can marry us. You don't need paperwork or anything, and it's legal across the world.
You gotta wonder if U.S. law even applies out in space. You can do all kinds of stuff, probably.
But the purpose of even giving the wife backstory is to explain Alta, who's the daughter who comes walking in. And now I'm like, oh, she's for sure a robot. They're throwing us off the trail by showing us an obvious robot. But the way she comes in, first of all, her arms are akimbo, kind of like C-3PO. And she's taking small steps. I'm like, oh, she is a robot. And we're going to find that out at the end. She's an evil killer she-robot.
No, that's Metropolis.
Again, I guess maybe I was influenced by my reading of The Tempest. Prospero did have a daughter and she ends up healing. She will end up getting romantically involved with one of the enemy, and that makes a happy ending. So I suspect that that's what's going to happen here. She ends up causing more problems, I think, that Farman and Adams both kind of go for her, and it creates a uncomfortable work environment as they work out that love triangle for a bit. But to me, she's clearly Eve, right? It's a forbidden planet. There's a garden out back, and she's this temptress, and
yeah, she's tempting everyone with that short skirt and just kissing everyone.
Yeah, and our main character is named Adams, like Adam and Eve. And
I never got that. You mentioned that it's called Forbidden Planet. I never understood the title, even at the end. I thought for sure they would be going to a forbidden planet, you know, kind of like After Earth. All the sensors say, don't go here. We know this is bad. But at no point do I understand why this planet is forbidden.
Because Morbius forbid it.
The story of the Tree of Knowledge is that, you know, you should be wary of eating that apple. And I do think that the alien technology represents that apple and the snake and what have you. No, technology. There's stuff that we aren't capable of understanding. And in fact, that is Morbius's position. I have been working for the last 20 years, and what I have discovered is so hot button, I can't risk bringing it back to Earth. And Adams wants to do that. He's like, you shouldn't be the only one to have this tech, and it's a fight of wills about what they're going to do.
Obviously, this is the A-bomb, right? I mean, I see a doctor who has powerful technology and a military guy saying you need to give it to us. I'm thinking nukes.
Certainly, that was the most pressing way you could look at technological development in the last 10 years and feel that, yes, maybe we had gone too far. I mean, it would have been spooky. Yeah, we won the war, but crap, we could kill ourselves. That dual realization kind of made a decade when half the time we were saying, yeah, we're the greatest, and the other time saying, yeah, we're going to kill ourselves. And so, yes, that is what's forbidden about this planet, is that their technology is mind-crushing. It literally could kill you if you try to understand it. And it did kill the alien race that was colonized here before. And in fact, they had traveled the universe. They had gone to Earth before we climbed out of the muck and taken our tigers and our deer and all. That's why they're all playing in the back with Alta.
I felt scared for the actress playing Alta with that tiger. Every time they faded and things, the film got grainy. There was a grain to that scene that made me wonder if it was some superimposition that was just really well done. But man, I felt scared for her, that tiger. You know, I mean, hell, if it could happen to Siegfried and Roy, it could happen to Alta.
Yeah, she's not in the same shot with the tiger. It's a composite shot.
Okay, so the grain did give it away, but that was the only thing that gave it away. It's better than the twins episodes of Facts of Life or whatever. I really thought I knew where this movie was going to take me, though. I thought for sure she was a fembot and that these three were going to team up for some reason. And again, I was thinking about the early Star Trek episodes. Like, are any of them human, or is one of them human and the others taking human forms? I'm thinking about the Salt Monster episode of Star Trek, if you guys remember that one, where there was a single human survivor left on a colony and it seemed like he was there with his wife, but his wife was actually a salt sucker. Murderous monster. So maybe these monsters were there to help him have a semblance of his life until he could just die at the end, but he could die thinking he had a daughter, something like that. Obviously, I was way the hell off.
No, so am I, because again, I'm focusing mostly on Robbie and like when he's having this discussion with the chef and yeah, I can make you 60 gallons of whiskey.
Oh my God, I thought that was so ominous. I thought the chef was dead.
Yes, I'm like, is he going to poison all the whiskey and kill the crew when they drink? Also, is this where they got the idea for Bender? If you ever watched Futurama, Bender is the robot who needs alcohol. The fact that Robbie's going to make 60 gallons of whiskey, I just felt like there's got to be a reference in there somewhere.
And again, because of Shakespeare, I'm thinking this guy's going to get liquored up and Robbie's going to give him a knife and be like, hey, do you want to go kill my master Morbius?
I thought for sure when the cook gives him the bourbon and he pours it in, I'm like, well, maybe that's going to turn Robbie evil. Like, he likes the liquor too much. It's going to start making him kill people.
Suddenly it's Reefer Madness. Yeah, it could have been that way. Given the 50s and how stilted they were and how much panic they like to instill about such things, they could have gone that route. But no, all of this really is to give Robbie an alibi, because he will be suspect number one when something invisible with giant footprints gets through the perimeter and gets into the ship and destroys valuable government equipment. That's what we're told.
A copper coil.
Yeah, while all the men are asleep.
Yeah, I love the discussion. We could do without everything else, but this coil, can we remake this? It's going to take time. I mean, I will say, as much as I like the matte paintings, I love all the theremin throughout this film for its score. It's a lot of static shots. Like, we're going to put the camera here and everyone frame yourself like it's a stage drama play that you're watching and we're going to talk and do our thing. And then it's not a lot of dynamic camera work. So having more modern film sensibilities, I just want the camera to move. move more. It's hard to keep interested at times.
Two things to that. One, it was shot in CinemaScope. We've talked about that format a little bit. It was the anamorphic process was something that got revived by Tarantino when he did Hateful Eight. And so those cameras can be a little bit unwieldy. They do their best here. I do feel like when we follow the footprints and there is a tracking shot that goes up the staircase and all, they try to. But the big selling point here would have been the color. We hadn't seen much sci-fi in color by this point other than This Island Earth. And keep in mind, TVs at the time, all black and white. So audiences would have wanted to come to the theater to have this experience they could get nowhere else. But my other point to the score, that is not theremin. I thought it was as well.
What?
Yeah. It's a very similar technique. What they did was that they went into the jazz clubs of Greenwich Village in the 1950s looking for the craziest, most experimental musicians they could find. And they found Bebe Lewis Barron, who had been making experimental scores based on basically sound effects. They kind of pioneered the synthesizer. They just like noises. And so they would do a lot of reverb and slowing sounds. And it ends up sounding a lot like a theremin, because a theremin is, you take a wand and you basically change pitch by waving it around in the air. Here they were doing similar things like that, but with dials and with machines of their own invention. But it was considered very, very hip to have made this score and to get it into a mainstream movie. Nothing like this had been done before. It is the first electronic score ever.
I don't know that I've ever heard it, but man, have I ever heard it parodied. You know, the ooh.
Yeah, that is a theremin. That's why I just assumed that's what they used.
Yeah, you would have already heard that sound effect in earlier movies. So it didn't pioneer that, but they took it a step further by making the entire score.
Oh yeah, the whole score here is that way.
And yeah, using devices that were even crazier than the theremin, essentially. It takes them a long time to work because they're cutting and repasting and rewinding magnetic tape. And so that's just different than playing instruments and being done with it. So they spend a lot of time on the score. It's not an easy listen, I will say that. I do feel like it is really atonal and really challenging. Sometimes it gets so loud, I'm just like, ugh, I'm more afraid of this than the monster that's coming. But
I don't think this is one I just listen to some music, but I like it in the film. I like the context it's in.
I agree completely. It's one of those scores that services the film well, but would be terrible driving music.
Mm-hmm. And again, it really heightens the scenes where we're getting the sense now that there is a real monster. And it's not Morbius, it's not Alta, it's not even Robbie the Robot. There is something invisible and big, and it leaves giant footprints, and it seems to be trying to warn them off. It is the thing that tore the previous crew limb to limb. And so this first time it's just a warning. I'll come in and I'll break up your ship, and so why don't you get out of here before I have to come back and kill Chief Quinn? Which is the second attack.
Yeah, the first attack, it does seem more like a theft, and I'm really confused by this. I'm again thinking, I thought the daughter did it, because I didn't think Robbie could maneuver in the ship, and then they cast the giant footprints, and it's like, how'd that even fit in the ship? Did it duck?
Yeah, I love that. And I love the fact that Adams is like, oh, Quinn could have taken that. There's no way that that kind of thing killed him. I'm like, an invisible giant dinosaur couldn't kill your crewmate? I think it could.
When they cast its footprint and you see this giant claw, they're like, it could be like a sloth. It's just there to hang on a tree.
Yeah, I do get a lot of Kirk. You know, Kirk has that pompous attitude. Leslie Nielsen usually plays it as comedy in his later performances. You know, he does that over-dramatic deadpan that just makes him seem too much. Here, we're expect to think that that's virile. That is what's to make him look more heroic than all of these other 17 bozos standing around. That's why he wins the girl and Furman is shut out.
I can't believe he wins the girl. He slut shames her. Like, go put some more clothes on, lady. You're driving all my men crazy.
I think it's pretty awful, though. Furman, he's like, well, let's kiss. And she's like, I don't feel anything. Well, let's kiss harder. And again, I'm like, she's a robot. She's not meant to feel anything. You're going to break her. But no, it's that she just didn't feel anything for Furman. But yeah, what she says to Adams, why don't you kiss me like all the other men? I'm like, how many men have been on your lips in the past day?
Yeah, well, she's trying to learn here. I mean, keep in mind, she has never seen anyone but her father and Robbie the robot. So, yeah, she's very, very excited to experiment here.
Yeah, she's skinny dipping, and Adams, he's so virtuous, he'll turn away while she gets out, but she has no problem with it.
She wasn't skinny dipping. She said she doesn't have a bathing suit, but she was in like a negligee or something. It's like she just wore a dress and jumped in the water. I thought she was skinny dipping too, but when she gets out, there's clearly some wet garment on her.
Yeah, you're not supposed to notice that. That was, I mean, it's flesh colored. They did their best to imply she's in the nude.
Oh, I just thought she was supposed to be wearing a negligee. Okay, I didn't realize that they were attempting something and failing.
And again, keep in mind the whole Eve thing, nude in the garden, and she wants to know what's wrong. And, you know, that her tiger friend certainly doesn't like seeing Leslie Nielsen sidle up to her and is even going to try and pounce on him. And we get a laser shot. You know, they got phasers on here. And so we get to see, you know, what the kind of stuff you want to see in a sci-fi film of the era. You want to see ray guns.
I was really wondering what the hell was up with that tiger. The tiger had been her friend her whole life. Is it that she started exuding some pheromones? She was getting horny and the tiger could smell it and decided to attack? What turned the tiger against her after all this time?
I would assume Adams. You're moving in on my woman. He didn't attack her. He attacked him.
I later looked this up because I was curious, and apparently there is a medieval myth of the unicorn could only be tamed by a virgin. And so what they were saying is the tiger was being tamed by the virgin, but now that she wasn't so virginal. And that was something that was apparently fleshed out. If you can believe it, there was a novelization of this, and it expanded a lot of scenes and some subplots. I couldn't find the book, but I read the wiki.
There are cut scenes, and if you get the big deluxe edition of this that's floating around, came out a few years ago. I don't feel like they add that much, but there is a long-winded speech in which she is seen as a unicorn. She walks up to the tiger and it tames, and that's when Leslie Nielsen compares her to, yeah, basically a virgin that can tame wild beasts. And so, yes, you're exactly right, that she's becoming more and more of a sexual being, and that seems to be a threat not only to the tigers, but I think to the father as well. I do think Morbius is not approving of the daughter developing her own personality. She will become less and less obedient, and that's what he requires. But he's distracted. He is oftentimes off in his lab, and eventually Leslie Nielsen gets tired of it, and he barges in, and we find out all about the backstory of this planet, the real thing that's going on.
Yeah, we get a big old data dump. We'll get, again, some cool matte paintings with them, I guess, superimposed. Like, they're walking down these giant halls. It's fun to look at. But the Krell, my question is, and Stuart, I think maybe you answered it. They were killed by the same thing that's killing, not the exact same thing, because that's Morbius's id, but they were killed by an id monster too?
Yeah, we'll get to the lines that are spoken towards the end. What we learn about them is that they're a race of creatures that are able to do anything with their mind. And that meant that they could travel space and time and all of that, but it also meant that they could annihilate themselves in a single night. What is said here earlier is that they became extinct 2,000 years ago in one single 24-hour period. And they left behind all of this cool test, like this carnival test your IQ machine. Strap it on your head and see if you can make a hologram.
Reminded me of, if you guys have seen Uncle Milton, had a toy that you'd put on your head.
Yes, I thought of that.
And it would measure your EEG waves and you could float a ball. They called it the force trainer because you were trying to use the force and get your beta waves to do a certain thing. But yeah, the fact that you put this little sensor on your head and it saw how high something floated made me think of that. The thing that confused me is I thought Morbius said that they were so intellectual that they were going to transcend being corporeal. So when they died in a night, I thought what he was saying is they just left their physical bodies behind and became creatures of pure knowledge and pure energy, and maybe they were the monster.
That's where I thought this was going. I'm right there with you.
I don't think anything like that is said, but I can see why you would think that, that they were still here on the planet and that they were so intellectual they didn't even use a body anymore. Why bother? I guess you could have played it that way.
It may be something about saying they don't need ambulatory or something about not needing limbs. Something is said by Morbius that made me think they didn't need bodies anymore, so maybe they aren't dead. Maybe they just evolved through their own tech. So now I'm thinking the Krell are the bad guys. I'm all over the map on this. I should have known science is always the bad guy in 50s sci-fi.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we see here, certainly when they get into the ductwork and we see these 20 miles of pistons and what have you, it's actually quite cool looking. It's all matte painting kind of stuff, but I think if you can go along with this aesthetic, it's really, really neat. And I think what we're seeing is God as a machine. This is something that responds and creates as a god. And in fact, he'll evoke a lot, like Greek myth, the Gorgon, when they're looking at the actual thermal nuclear reaction that powers it all, they're looking through mirrors. That's how you can look at Medusa, because if you look at her straight, it'll turn you into stone. They're using all kinds of myths to describe supernatural powers that are beyond human contemplation. What I see here is that, yes, we are now playing with power, go ahead and call it nuclear, that is too dangerous to try and control. And Morbius doesn't want to take it back to Earth, and they don't want to leave without taking Morbius.
Adam says something about, I need to wait for orders. I don't know that he ever actually gets orders. So for all their faster-than-light travel, they can't really radio home very fast.
Yeah, it's going to take 10 days to construct this whole thing. And, you know, Robbie's got to bring some lead sheeting. And who knows all that's involved in it. It's a whole big MacGuffin. It has no real consequence to the story. I think what motivates the climax and getting this to an end is that Farman finally gets killed on the third attack of the monster. And we finally see it this time, courtesy of a Walt Disney animator.
Oh, I like this. You see these electrical outlines of it. You never see like the full thing fully formed, but yeah, like all the little animated hints of what's coming at him.
It's silly, but I love it. I think it helps that I'm going with the movie and I'm into the mysteries, but that I'm not laughing at it, but instead I'm looking at that and I'm like, that's actually kind of cool. Even if nobody looks like they're firing a gun, they're just like limply holding guns that are shooting these lasers.
Well, it reminds me when they made PG Walt Disney movies. Like, it's about as scary as, like, The Black Hole or Tron or something like that, where it's still Disney. It has that feel. And, in fact, they did pilfer this guy. MGM called up Walt Disney and said, send us your best guy. And they sent over the guy that did the dinosaur sequence in Fantasia. If you've ever seen that one, there's a whole evolution that they depict to classical music. Josh Mader was behind that. And so some of those sequences in Fantasia are quite frightening in a Disney kind of way. That's what I would say about this monster. It works in a Disney kind of way. They talked about all other ways to do it. They were going to get Ray Harryhausen and do it stop motion. They were actually going to put Morbius's head on two legs, and just since it was his id, you would see that it was actually, you know, him. I saw a model of it. It was kind of creepy, but it would kind of telegraph where they were going before they revealed the whole idea of the id monster. In the end, this is sort of the cutest way that they were looking at going.
Yeah, again, I like the aesthetic. I will say, Arnie, you talk about them limply shooting those guns. I'm like, get a director on the set here. Tell these people they're like in a battle for their life. They are so nonchalant about saving themselves with these little pew pew ray guns that they have.
And the monster, you know what it reminded me of is, do you guys remember from Looney Tunes, the orange, hairy, amorphous monster that kind of looks like an upside-down scrotum?
Yes.
It kind of looked like that to me, only without the hair.
Yeah, there's something cute about it. There is something cartoon about it, not just animated, because they've had a couple animated sequences in here, but this feels cartoon, and I think the decision was, we don't want to scare the audience too much. They had some designs that were much creepier. You know, this wasn't rated G because that rating system didn't exist, but they were definitely thinking science fiction movies should have appeal to the whole family. And later on, they did re-release it as a G-rated film and cut out all the love scenes, actually, and just kind of focused on this kind of stuff.
Looking at today's youth and children and whatnot, I'd think that by the time we get to the scene of the attacking monster, kids would either be asleep or rioting. I think it took a little too long to get here for the youngest of kiddies.
For the youngest of today's kids? Well, I mean...
Well, I mean, they're the only ones I know. I didn't know children of the 50s. I know children of the 90s and on, and I don't know any of them that would have stuck with this movie long enough to get to this one action scene.
I mean, speaking bluntly, I wonder if kids can look up from their phone to watch any movie, but I take your point. And so now we have a climax. Farman is dead. That clears the way. And he approved. He was like, the right man ended up with Alta. So it wasn't even like a lingering decision that had to be made between the space girl and which guy from Earth she's going to pick. But now Commander Adams is going to invoke some kind of Section 86A article and take them back by force. You're just coming with us. We're leaving now. And that's when he meets Robbie at the door.
And this is where he turns evil, right? He won't let him through.
Well, he neutralizes their blasters, but he can't kill them. He stays true to his programming. He cannot do anything to harm them, and he ultimately has to obey Alta, who says, go ahead and let him in.
That's what I'm saying. It's so anticlimactic. I thought, here's the showdown with Robbie. We're going to see them fight a robot. And then, yeah, the girl just comes and says, step aside, let him through.
Truthfully, Robbie is completely underutilized in this, right? Robbie needed to do more of something. I thought for sure, again, I'm thinking about Star Trek episode Mudd's Women, where they have those robots that they can't overpower, so they have to use logic. So Captain Kirk says, Harry Mudd can't tell the truth. And then Harry Mudd says, but I'm lying. And so that puts them in a logical fallacy until their CPUs overheat and they blow up. I thought for sure Robbie the robot was going to blow up because of the conflict in his programming about hurting humans or something. No, he's just going to spin his wheels and then Alta's going to be like, yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, you're not going to blow up Robbie. They only made one of these. He was very expensive. He was like a fourth of the production budget went to just this suit and the actor and all of that. They could not afford to do anything to Robbie, and they didn't want to. Again, I think he is the thing you remember about this movie. He will end up being the new Astrogator. Because Farman is dead, they'll need someone to pilot the ship, and it will be Robbie to get him off the planet.
I'm disappointed nobody got torn limb from limb. We saw a couple people picked up and thrown, but I wanted to see some limbs ripped off. I don't know about you guys.
I knew that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, you have to set that phaser on mild stun. It's not even really that stunning, but you have to know the decade. You cannot expect this. This is darker than most. What I can say is usually what I reject about the 1950s, really a lot of the genres of Hollywood, is how cheesy and stilted the performances can be, the messaging can be. You think of something that is very idealistic and shiny and impossibly so. But here, once we kind of get into what the heart of the monster is, there's something kind of dark about claiming that we have all of us, every single person, and even these Krell have like an inner demon that can be unleashed by science.
And I know Freud, he was around talking about the id, like to me, 1956, that seemed like, oh, that might be a little bit ahead of the curve there to try to get into the psychology of what's going on in the brain. I thought that was some neat exploration. They don't do a whole lot with it, but it was neat that it was in there.
Agreed. I was thinking when they said id, I'm like, do they mean id as in id, ego, and superego? That's exactly what they meant.
Yes, these concepts would have been something that mainstream Hollywood wouldn't have gone near. I can think of very few films that evoke Freud in this era. Now, there's a lot of people that are deconstructing films and, you know, Freudian film theory, but nobody would have dared say there's an id monster. And so that is the thing that I think is, you know, maybe just as revolutionary as Robbie, is the idea that, yes, what killed off the Krell are their inner ambitions, their lusts, the things that they couldn't control that were magnified by their technology. And because Morbius played with that technology, it was his id monster that killed his crew that wanted him to go home early. And now it's going to even kill his daughter because she's defying him and saying, I want to go home with Leslie Nielsen.
Well, yeah, it's again, it seems like maybe it's a bit ahead of the curve. Maybe it's just how I'm interpreting it. But I would think, oh, we're afraid of the Soviets. We got to make our atom bombs. But it's really us that we have to fear. We have to fear ourselves. We're the monsters that are going to destroy us, not the Soviets over the wall.
It's actually a line. We're all part monsters. Yeah, that's bold. I don't think many 50s movies advocate that there's all bad guys. Like, usually there's very clear white hats and black hats, and you just don't have moral ambiguity. But here, they're going to put it forward as such. And I think it can just go over your head. If you're not really paying attention, you're thinking, oh no, this scientist Morbius, he's the bad guy, and he brought it on all of them, and Leslie Nielsen is clearly the hero, so they're going to have to battle this invisible monster one more time as it's tearing through the metal shutters. Adamantium. I want to point out the Krell invented Wolverine's claws.
Yeah, I thought he said adamantium steel. I'm like, really? I think this was really impactful. I've heard the Krell used in other sci-fi things, and then I heard adamantium. A lot of people took from this. And yeah, I never realized Adamantium was not a Stan Lee original or Chris Claremont or whoever did that.
Yeah, this is a reason why you go back to 50s science fiction, is because all the people that you like that created things later watched this and took things from it, and now you can spot them. And so that is what we're doing. And this is where we find out that Doc has tried to jump onto the machine and wield the power and gotten answers about what's actually going on, but it's going to cost his life. I do think that in the advertising, they sold it that Robbie would be carrying the woman in his arms. But in fact, we actually see in the film is he's carrying the Doc to the couch. That's where he's going to expire.
Oh, yeah. My girls were like, he never carried the woman. The poster lied. They were very disappointed.
Yeah, and he gets the last dying declaration about monsters of the id.
And it's kind of exciting. I mean, you know, it's stilted like a lot of this. You know, you can tell we're on a set and the trees are falling down or with the help of ropes and what have you. But there's still something exciting about thinking about this invisible force that basically I thought maybe they would have it for Morbius to take control of his id or to manifest his ego or superego to try and fight back with it. I thought they could potentially go very Freudian. I'm not sure how they stop it.
Well, I thought it was because Morbius dies, so it dies.
Yeah, exactly. He tries to fight it and it kills him, and then he dies when the planet blows up and it goes with him because it's his id. It's his manifestation.
Yeah, but I mean, he doesn't just like die right there. Like they end up hiding in the lab and it's, you know, dramatically tearing through the steel and melting it and getting in there. And then he's like, all right, hit the self-destruct and you have 24 hours to get away. I don't know why the id stops.
Maybe he can't fly. I mean, they do just take off into space. I don't know if he could chase them out there.
Also, he's quite wounded, and that may hurt his power to conjure the id. I mean, he's doing it. He just doesn't realize he's doing it.
Why is he wounded?
He's wounded because the creature slashes him. He's hit by the creature, and then the creature goes away. So maybe he lost his power to generate the id at that moment.
I see. Okay. That blow from his own id has been maybe a mortal blow. It's why they don't take him with them, because I'm like, well, you could take this guy back, if nothing else, to court-martial, but it seems right that Dr. Frankenstein should die for his sins, and so we don't want him hovering around either as Leslie Nielsen is going to finally bed Anne Francis.
I thought it was another trick. Again, I'm always looking for a step more depth or duplicity than the movie has, because he's like, hit this button, turn that plate, I've deactivated the self-destruct. I was expecting that, you fool, you've killed us all. No, he's like, you got hours, just go away.
I thought it was a self-destruct for just the lab, and then they're like, no, it's for the planet. That is a crazy self-destruct for the Krell to build in. They don't need id monsters. They blew up their own planet if you just push this lever down.
Yeah, Prospero does something kind of similar, in which he does magic that he knows will end, eventually quickly bring about his death. And he is more or less giving his blessing for the new generation to go on and continue without him. So there's a little bit of that here. I feel like he wants his daughter to be happy and to maybe see a little bit of the universe that he's shielded her from. And we certainly want to watch a planet blow up. I mean, like, that's a sci-fi staple.
Is it? I didn't know it was back then. I mean, I just thought an entire planet blowing up was literally overkill. But once I realized this was about nukes, I took that just as a literalization of the metaphor of how nuclear technology can destroy the whole planet.
Oh, absolutely. And again, you see that in so many films of that era and beyond. I mean, the disaster film came out of this decade as well, and that is because we could finally conceive of something that could destroy on such a mass scale. I mean, they sum it up quite nicely. Leslie Nielsen ends with the statement, we are reminded that we are not God.
Which I do dig this film a little bit for. It's like the end of The Fly where, oh, look at, he tried to do this great thing, but it should have never been tried. And no, you're going and exploring space and learning stuff. That's a good thing. Just be careful with the technology. It doesn't mean you have to write it all off.
And I think that's part of it, is just knowing our own darker impulses. That's what I was taking all the id stuff as, is yes, we think we're noble and good and we're the ones who can control the nukes, but there's the dark side to all people, and so who's to say what will happen? Yeah, I guess a little bit of moralizing. It's wrapped up quickly. That's what I can really yes. give it. And so if this went on, I might have a bigger problem with it. But it's like a few lines at the end, and then the credits roll, and I go, oh yeah, that was Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah, you can either see it as a happy ending, the guy gets the girl, or you could see it as, you know, keep watching the skies, or you're next. I mean, I do feel like there's something ominous about the fact that they have power that, yes, could destroy us.
I didn't think it was ominous at all, because everything evil was destroyed in that planet blowing up. I didn't see anything there that I thought would have continued. The way keep watching the skies was like, there's more carrot monsters. If there was any hint that the id monster was on the ship.
It is.
They're all id monsters.
Yeah, everyone's an id monster, and Robbie is with them. Robbie is navigating that ship. A part of that technology is going back.
Yeah, but by this point, I take Robbie as their mascot. He didn't do anything dangerous. I just kept expecting more from him.
That's because you didn't see the sequel, I guess.
Sequel?
Yeah, we'll talk about it.
All right, well, we'll get there. First, Jacob, Stuart, do you recommend going to the Forbidden Planet? Jacob.
You know, Stuart, you said something. It's nice to go back to these old movies and you see all the inspirations for the stuff you actually like. That feels like you're kind of getting into that homework category that Artie has for some films. And yeah, is this film only worth it because it's homework for future sci-fi? Or is there some value to it as just a motion picture? And it definitely has that homework side where if you love sci-fi, yeah, when Robbie says, I speak 187 languages, I'm like, ah, I know where Lucas got that line for C-3PO in A New Hope. So there is fun in that, but I think there is more worth this film than just that homework category. Again, a lot of it's aesthetic. I love the matte paintings. I love this avant-garde score. Yeah, the animation for the id monster, all that stuff, it's fun to look at, it's fun to watch. And then I do like when they get into that idea, they bring in that psychology. It's not just, oh, nukes are bad and communists are bad. It starts to get a little bit deeper than a lot of that 50s stuff that has turned me off. So that is what I appreciate about this film. That is why I would recommend this film, because one, aesthetically, it's just a great film to look at. And yeah, it gets into some themes that are a little deeper than a lot of sci-fi. I'd like to actually see this kind of explored some more and have a more sophisticated take on the whole id thing. And I think you could come up with something really great about that, you know, our fears turning into monsters and all that. It's a classic because of Robbie, even though Arnie, you're right, he does not do much in this film. But yeah, I think this is one worth watching. So I'll give it a recommend.
Stuart.
Yeah, I'm going to draw the line in the sand as 1956. I don't like science fiction that predates this movie and Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But I do like when science fiction can take interesting ideas and explore them with a little bit of darkness. It's really hard for a lot of 50s movies to do because they are so badly made and so idealistic and so propagandist. But this movie, it plays with Freudian ideas of the id and our darker nature. It sells the idea that technology is dangerous. I mean, I do feel like we think of Robbie as dangerous. I think of that id monster as being dangerous. It has an edge to it. Even though it's splashy and colorful like the musicals of the era, I think that there is something dark and cool too. And it honestly, I know it inspired Star Trek and Star Wars, but I feel like it's closer as well and kin to some of the dark, pessimistic sci-fi that I like as well. I mean, I don't feel like it projects an overimportance on the droids or mankind's greatness. I think that it has an interesting perspective on where we were as a society 10 years after dropping the bomb. And so, yeah, I think it works certainly as homework, but I also think it just stands on its own. And honestly, I would love to see it remade.
And yeah, I'm the one who brought up the homework idea. And here's the difference between a movie that's homework and not. Is it enjoyable to watch at the time? Or is it a movie that you'd never watch for fun and you're only watching to intellectually analyze and take apart? I came into this knowing very little and not even knowing if I would like it or not. I haven't seen a lot of sci-fi from the time. I had bad memories of The Thing from Another World, a completely repressed mole man. But I came in here and I found myself enjoying it, but it was really tickling a nostalgia bone for me from when I really was a hardcore Trekkie. And I was a Trekkie before there was the Next Generation. Not much before, but I was watching all those original series episodes, and they had matte paintings like this and plots just like this. And you could replace Freeman and Doc and Adams with Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and you could have had this exact plot there. To me, this was an enjoyable episode of Star Trek the Original Series, so beyond even the homework reason, I'd give it a recommend. But I also did enjoy the knowledge that it brought of seeing where it came from, like Adamantium and Robbie the Robot, and just being able to see the origins of this stuff was enjoyable on a more intellectual level. It's a must-see for the homework aspect, but it's a fun time if you do.
Yeah, I think that it already has been remade. I mean, Solaris and what have you. There's so many people that...
I was going to say, when you wanted a remake, go see Solaris.
Yeah, there have been... I don't really like the Russian one. The George Clooney one was okay, but...
I have not seen the George Clooney one. Yeah, the Russian one, it's very slow.
Yeah, it's painful. But again, a fountainhead of great ideas. But, you know, usually... if I only see it as homework, I'm just like, boy, I wish I could cut and paste. I wish I could take the things I like out of this and put it into something I like. And this movie I liked. I mean, I did enjoy the whole experience. So again, it's an endorsement for this movie, not just an endorsement for the ideas of what they put forth.
Well, you know, I didn't expect this to be three recommends, but Craig, I'm glad it was, because it's a movie you enjoy, and it's one you introduced all three of us to, and we enjoy it. So, Stuart, should I go on and see the sequel now?
Yeah, if we had done this without a patron donation, we might have been required, because it's, I would argue, it is a direct sequel, but with different aesthetic ideas. I mean, Robbie will continue to get work 1 year after Forbidden Planet, even though it wasn't a big hit. They realized they had a big hit in that robot, so they got a different director, a lower budget, some black and white film, no CinemaScope, and they retconned it. Some scientist from 1950s suburbia invents a time machine, goes into the future, brings Robbie back from Altair 4, and now he is living as the pet of a 10-year-old named Timmy, helping him to beat his dad in chess, fly a glider, and yes, turn him invisible, because the movie is called The Invisible Boy.
Is it as good as this?
Here's the surprise. What I have just described to you sounds like a very unimpressive Disney film.
Yes.
I was shocked that they kept the technophobic edge. The movie is still scary, and Robbie is still scary. He kills people. He strangles people on camera. He brainwashes people and gives them microchips. He kidnaps Timmy and then boasts that he knows enough about human anatomy that he could torture him to the brink of death.
This is the Robbie movie Artie wants.
Yeah, it is, or at least what I expected, if not necessarily want.
Yeah, it plays a lot more like Invaders from Mars 1953. It's a child paranoia where, like, your best friend suddenly becomes an abductor of sorts. And, like, he's stolen into a rocket. And I wouldn't say it was intense or even that good, but I was impressed that it was daring. It held my interest. It wasn't great. It was fine. And, you know, they give Robbie a pass. At the end, we find out that there was a bigger, more evil computer controlling him. And so that means they can defeat that computer and let Robbie stay in suburbia and, you know, become the pet that we all wanted in the 1950s. And he would continue on. The year after that, he would appear on an episode of The Thin Man, which was a popular detective show in which Nick and Nora Charles and their dog Asta go around solving crimes. Well, Robbie the robot is accused of killing a scientist, and they take a different tack on that. They actually find out that it was actually some Luddite who thought that man was playing with fire with all this technology and framed the robot as the killer. I guess he thought nobody would invent any more robots if they could prove that the robot had turned on his master. And Robbie, you know, again, for decades as Toys and Lost in Space, Wonder Woman, he even had a cameo in Gremlins. I do think that he is one of the most popular robot creations of all time.
That's right. I remember you bringing him up back when we did Gremlins and some of that stuff I didn't recognize. But, you know, I have The Invisible Boy. It came with the Blu-ray I got of Forbidden Planet. I might check it out. You've kind of made me interested.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, it's about as good as some of those Fly sequels.
Well, I liked one of those well enough to put in our book, so I'll check it out. So, if that's Forbidden Planet this month, what are we doing next month for our patrons?
Well, when I saw the trailer for Shazam, a DC movie we're required to cover on our main feed...
Required? I want to. That looks fun.
It really made me want to go back and look at Big. I mean, the story of a child who grows up too fast and finds out that, yeah, superpowers, or at least the superpower of being an adult, is a double-edged sword. I think that's the story they're going to tell in that DC movie, and it's the movie we're going to explore as an April patron show. Big.
Okay, but I get to be on top.
And of course, we just lost Penny Marshall as well, so I do think it'll be servicing as some kind of tribute as well.
Well, I look forward to that. I haven't seen Big in a while, a few years, so it'll be nice to return to that. But once again, I do want to thank all of our patrons for joining us for this podcast and continuing to support our show. It's really exciting. I've been having talks with website design companies. We actually hit the milestone. I didn't know if we ever would, to hire a company to bring in a professional website design team and revamp our site from the bottom up. So that is in progress, and it's all because of you. So thank you so much, and especially thanks to Clark Fisher. We really appreciate your support and hope you've enjoyed this show as much as we've enjoyed the movie.
Hear, hear.
Until next time, I'm going to go give myself an oil job.
About a million years from now, the human race will have crawled up to where the Krell stood in their great moment of triumph and tragedy. And your father's name will shine again, like a beacon in the galaxy. It's true, it will remind us that we are, after all, not God.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Oh, go on, get out of here before I ever run out of the area under guard, and then I'll put more guards in the guards.
And a special thank you to Clark for his support of the show and choosing Forbidden Planet for our review.
Robbie, I ain't never gonna forget this. Anytime you're hard up for a couple of gallons of lubog, you just let me know.
Now Playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going. So thanks to you all.
There's enough power for a whole population of creative geniuses, operated by the electromagnetic impulses of individual Krell brains.
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
Nice climate you have here. High oxygen content.
I rarely use it myself, sir. It promotes rust.
If you want even more Now Playing reviews, place your order now for the first Now Playing book, Underrated Movies We Recommend. Get reviews of 125 films our hosts love. You can order the book by clicking the banner at the top of our homepage.
A sheer bulk surpassing many million earthly libraries.
You're able to read this?
A little, it's my profession.
You can follow Now Playing on Facebook and Twitter, where we post announcements of new episodes and where the hosts post movie mini reviews. Links to our social media pages are available on our homepage.
Now, if you will follow me, I will show you some of their other remaining artifacts.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
Commanding officer doesn't need brains, just a good loud voice.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
The fool, as though his ape's brain could contain the secrets of the Krell.
Now Playing is edited by Steven and Arnie.
If you're anywhere in the galaxy, this is a nightmare.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
Man does not behold the face of the Gorgon and live.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
You still refuse to face the truth.
What truth?
Morbius, that thing out there. It's you.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
We're all part monsters in our subconscious. So we have laws and religion. You've got to listen.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved. Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2019. All rights reserved. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
This has been very pleasant. You've seen how comfortable I am here. No hardships, no special difficulties, and no need at all for military assistance. Now I dare say you're impatient to get back to base.
Yes, sir.
We find out now is been the place where Bellophone, a scientific mission.
Bellerophone.
Is it Bellerophone?
It's Bellerophone. We just need Chimera.
Yeah, she's not in the same shot with a tiger. It's a composite shot.
Okay, so the grain did give it away, but that was the only thing that gave it away. It's better than the twins episodes of Facts of Life or whatever.
I don't remember that episode.
Every sitcom had some twin episode. I don't remember a specific one.
Sorry. I thought you meant with a tiger. It was the tiger that was holding it.
Oh, no, with the twins. Yes. So they got to do the composite shot.
Yeah. I was going to say it looks better than the episode where Data has his twin brother, Lore, but I felt I've referenced Star Trek enough that I didn't need to jump to Next Generation. In the 23rd century, mankind has realized the dream of faster-than-light travel and spread our manifest destiny into the cosmos, colonizing habitable worlds. I'm proud of that one. Manifest destiny into the cosmos.